This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Earlier this month, an Iranian rocket attack in Iraq struck American and coalition forces. And this week, the administration of Joe Biden took its first military action retaliating against that strike. But it wasn't exactly the kind of response that will strike fear in Iran. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, the Iranians have been at work for the last few months attacking U.S. forces, U.S. bases. And this has really increased over the past week, going back to the attack in Erbil, which was at the international airport and a base that is adjacent to that the United States uses. And U.S. service members were injured in that rocket attack. There was one civilian contractor that was killed. And then since that time, the U.S. air base, the Balad air base, has been targeted in Iraq. The green zone where the Baghdad embassy of the United States is, that was targeted in an attack as well. So there have been several attacks against U.S. forces. And the Biden administration has been saying that they were looking at who was the culprit, who was behind this for the past week, and that they would have a proportionate attack or a proportional response in a place of their choosing. And so that came. And funnily enough, it didn't come in Iran. It didn't come in Iraq. It actually came across the border into Syria, where overnight or on Thursday, there was the Abu Kamal border region where Iran and Iranian-backed militias kind of transit the border between Iraq and Syria. This is a known location for Iranian forces. It's been attacked numerous times before by Israelis, by the U.S. This was the chosen place. Kirby, who's now the Admiral Kirby, I think it is, who's now the spokesperson for the Pentagon, he said that this airstrike destroyed multiple facilities at a border control point used by a number of Iranian-backed militant groups. And so we haven't got a death count yet. There's been some reports that 19 people were killed. However, that was not by a government agency. That was by the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, I think it's called. There might have been one person killed, is what Reuters is saying, but we're not sure yet. And so this was the choice. This was not an Iranian target. This was a target that is in Syrian territory, not even an Iraqi target, and by the Biden administration.
To hear the new defense secretary talk about this, this was a really bold, targeted, this is how to deal with this threat in the most severe way possible. But it's hard not to look at this as being somewhat of a joke. Like, how will this actually, what sort of effect is this going to have on Iran?
Yeah, I think Michael Rubin, he made this point very well today in his piece, Joe Biden's Syria airstrike hit the wrong target. He says this: despite Biden's efforts to emphasize proportionality, the strike was not proportional. This whole doctrine that they hit you with a one-ton bomb, kills one person, you've got to hit them back with a one-ton bomb, kills one person, or something like that. That's a proportional response. And Biden's efforts, that's what they said in their statement, that they were going for proportionality. Maybe I'll read that statement first. This was the statement from the Pentagon. This proportionate military response was conducted together with diplomatic measures, including consultation with our coalition partners. So what's interesting about that is these coalition partners that are involved in this, that would have been talking to the Iraqi government, and they would have been saying, this is what we're going to do. Who's part of the Iraqi government? Well, a lot of the Shiite militias that would have ordered the attack on the American base. Mm. And so they would have told the Iraqi militias, hey, get out of that location. The United States is about to attack that. Because that's basically what this is saying, at least according to experts that have analyzed this statement. And then it says in this statement by the U.S., at the same time, we have acted in a deliberate manner that aims to de-escalate the overall situation in both Syria and Iraq. So is that what you want to do? Do you want to strike in a way that's not going to offend somebody to strike back again? That's what they've done here with this seemingly proportional response. Michael Rubin says it wasn't even proportional. Listen to him. Despite Biden's efforts to emphasize proportionality, the airstrike was not proportional. Rather, it was less. A U.S. embassy or an airport where U.S. forces reside are not the equivalent of a dusty outpost used as a T-stop for militiamen traversing from Iraq into Syria. Nor are U.S. forces the equivalent of an Iranian-backed militia. A proportional response would be more directly target Iranian interests or property. The danger is not Iranian escalation, but rather the normalization of rocket attacks on embassies or airport. Mm-hmm. A response is meant to deter aggression, the same aggression from happening again. And yet the Iranians, looking at this response from the Biden administration, would be crazy to be deterred. They hit a dusty outpost where a few of their militiamen stand. Mm-hmm. And this was in response to a direct attack on American forces inside Iraq.
So this is a real vivid picture of what we're dealing with the Biden administration that is so intent on prioritizing Iran over everything else in its foreign policy in the Middle East. And when Iran actually strikes directly against American interests, the Biden administration has to find a way to look like it's doing something while still tiptoeing around this the elephant in the room and preserving negotiation power and the ability to continue to engage with this rogue regime.
Right. You don't want to make the Iranians walk away from the table by hitting back strong against an Iranian target. And that is going to be the shadow that hangs over every single decision of retaliation that the Biden administration does not, you know, follow through on or come across hard on against Iran. They need to give Iran cover and a pass. I think it's interesting this attack did not even take place in Iraq. Why didn't it take place in Iraq? Why not hit Kataib Hezbollah, really powerful Iranian proxy inside Iraq? Perhaps it is because the Iranians have said, don't touch Iraq. That's ours. I mean, biblical prophecy, we know that Iraq is going to fall to Iran. And perhaps we're even past that point where the United States has given that up, has given Iraq up to the Iranians. But this happened before. This happened for years, not leading up to 2015, when the deal was struck the last time. Again, we've talked a lot about this, how the Syrian civil war was perpetuated under the cover of the negotiations. The red line that Obama drew in the sand that says, if you use chemical weapons on your people, Assad, we're going to come in, we're going to toast you. That he used chemical weapons. We just had that anniversary last week. 1,000 people were killed in one chemical weapon attack with sarin gas, a nerve agent. And President Obama walked away. Why? Because he wanted the Iranians to deal. And he knew that if he'd attacked Assad, an Iranian ally, with in such force, that the Iranians wouldn't be inclined to negotiate a nuclear deal with the Obama administration. So we're seeing the same type of thing. And I think what's important to recognize is that there is, I mean, we always get back to the darker motive here, and that is that the Obama administration, this third term of the Obama administration, fully understands the Iranians and the way they work. And they are fine with people just knowing this, that Iran has cover now to act because the United States wants a nuclear deal. That's why the Biden administration's not acting strong. Okay, we get it. But really, that's even hiding the deeper, darker secret that the Obama administration and the Biden administration, they actually share the Iranian regime's goals. They share the Iranian regime's thought pattern that the America is to blame for everything that is wrong in the Middle East. And so Iran is justified at going against our forces in the Middle East. I know it might sound crazy to believe that, but that's the truth. Mm-hmm. And they have stated as much, and there's plenty of people, a lot of smart people that are starting to write this as well, that maybe the mullahs in Iran, they share the same ideology as the Biden administration does back home. And President Obama, again, he wanted to fundamentally transform America. And that's because America, as he saw it, was evil. And so it makes sense then that America's traditional foreign policy was evil. America's allies in the Middle East, they're not worth supporting. In fact, our enemies probably have it right as well. And we go into this in an article in the latest Trumpet magazine. It's entitled The Middle East Allies Be Warned, Obama is Back. It goes into some of the prophecy backing this as well. And this is something that we need to get used to over the next length of time, however long Joe Biden's in the presidency. Look for more of this propping up the Iranian regime, letting it get free passes as the United States makes it easier for Iran to access funds to continue Iran's goals in the Middle East.
Yeah, we do have that article in the New Trumpet. We also have Chapter 6 of Great Again, where Gerald Flory writes about this, the Iranian deal struck by Obama. The title of that chapter is The Most Dangerous Lie in History. Very strong chapter that gives tremendous perspective on what happened there. And now we see this revival of that failed policy under the Biden administration. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Well, while America is favoring Iran in its foreign policy, Germany is preparing for war with Iran. That certainly is evident when you look at Germany's actions through the lens of Bible prophecy. We're closely evaluating Germany's military maneuvers by this standard, and this week we saw more evidence of this. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so I have what I think is just a really revealing story, and a story that really makes no sense unless you put it in that prophetic context. And that is that the German cabinet have given their approval for German troops to remain in Afghanistan until 2022. Now, they can extend that again, but Germany's parliament has to give a mandate for all of Germany's overseas troop deployment. And this mandate was set to expire in April. And in fact, all NATO troops are meant to be out of Afghanistan by the spring, at least under the timetable that President Trump agreed. Now, though, they've extended that, giving German troops permission to stay there much longer. It still needs to be approved by parliament. That should just be a rubber stamp. The government has an easy majority there. This cabinet decision was the one that was more critical. And I think this is just fascinating. You know, Germany has tended to be one of the more reluctant nations to place its troops around the world. Yet it has got over 1,000 troops in Afghanistan years after Britain pulled out. You know, typically, and everywhere you look, generally, who's the more reliable partner for the United States? It tends to be Britain. You know, Britain went with America to war in Iraq. Germany and France sat it out. So why is it that Germany is staying in Afghanistan for years and years and years? And this is not just some token deployment. This is their largest overseas military deployment. This is, I think, the only one or one of the only ones that's got above 1,000. It's a really significant mission. But they're continuing. And it looks like the American troops, I think they're going to continue as well. They're not going to withdraw. And Germany has been talking to the United States about that. So I think that just reveals a lot. Their decision to stay reveals a lot about Germany's attitude.
So let's get into this prophecy a little bit. I'm reminded of the late Trumpet writer Ron Fraser writing about this from the very beginning when Germany went into Afghanistan. And he said, Germany is never going to leave. When you look at the reason why it's establishing its presence there in the context of what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, has called Germany's whirlwind strategy, kind of surrounding Iran. Afghanistan is a key part of that. Can you talk about the bigger picture as far as military intervention by Germany?
Yeah, I've got these articles up, actually. I mean, here's one, for example, from 2013 by Mr. Fraser, Why Germany is Staying in Afghanistan. Now, he almost had these on an annual basis as Germany kept extending that even while Britain was leaving. And yeah, he said exactly that in that article. When you understand Germany's strategy, you see they're not going to be easy to quit or quick to quit here at all. But we have a small booklet that I can point you to that really does answer this well, Germany's Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran. It's just a couple of quick chapters there. But there's a very specific prophecy that this ties directly into. So Daniel chapter 11 is one of the key passages of scripture for this end time, and it describes a clash between a modern-day European power and an Iranian-led Islamist power in the Middle East. And there are so many details. There's only five or six verses that talk about this prophecy or this particular aspect of the clash, but there are so many details crammed into those few verses. And one of these details comes from this word whirlwind. It talks about this king of the north, this European power, coming against the king of the south like a whirlwind. And this is describing a tremendously intense attack. When you look at this word whirlwind, there's a sense of terror. There's a good chance it could even use nuclear weapons, and it's an all-on attack. At the same time, though, it also has this look at the Hebrew word, and it has connotations of surrounding, coming from all sides. And how does Germany come at Iran, this king of the south, from all sides? Well, that requires some preparation. That requires some forethought. It requires setting up bases that surround Iran and all of Iran's other terror proxies and centers of operations. And so Mr. Flurry, in this booklet, he's describing this verse, and he says, this isn't simply a straight-on assault. It's a storm that whirls around and around, invading the land and flooding into it. The king of the north couldn't come like a whirlwind unless it surrounds Iran and its allies. That is being meticulously planned right now. Germany is busy preparing to execute a whirlwind strategy to rush up and overflow Iran. If you study what is happening in that territory surrounding Iran today, you already see Germany all over it. Daniel 11 and verse 40 is already in the early stages of being fulfilled. There are people in Germany, I don't think Angela Merkel is one of those people, but there are people in Germany planning ahead and considering this confrontation. And then when you consider Iran's geography, I think that makes it even more clear exactly why they've got to stay in Afghanistan. You know, Iran is much easier to invade from the east than it is from the west. You've got some pretty hefty mountain ranges. You've got the Zagros Range and others on its western border. It would be much easier to come at them from the other side. So you see the necessity of Germany, of their planning this far ahead, of having a base on the other side of Iran, a side that's harder for them to get to initially. And so you see how important it is for Germany to set that up.
Well, pretty fascinating to see that strategy actually come to fruition. That booklet, again, by Gerald Flurry, Germany's Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran, really important booklet highlighting that prophecy. We thank you very much for that, Richard. One of the last actions President Trump took before leaving office was to charge China with genocide over what it is doing to its Uyghur population. Well, this week, two other nations followed America's lead. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, that was a big deal, that parting blow that the Trump administration left for China. That happened on January 19th, just, you know, one day before President Trump vacated the presidential office there. And they basically said, yes, what China's doing with the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang, it does equate to genocide. That's not a label that's used casually at all, but the State Department, under the direction of Mike Pompeo, said that they had conducted a very thorough review of the available evidence, and they had concluded that what China's doing fits the definition. The Chinese Communist Party is engaged in what they called, quote, systematic attempts to destroy the Uyghurs. So that was a fitting label. And when we spoke about that on Trumpet Hour, as you said, we sort of asked about what other nations would do. This puts a lot of other countries in a tight spot because it puts pressure on them. Will they follow the U.S.'s lead on taking a firm stance against these systematic atrocities, or will they keep on kind of ignoring it and deflecting? And this week, we started to see some momentum build toward that end. First, on Monday, the Canadian Parliament declared that this treatment of the Uyghurs is indeed a genocide. The motion there passed 266-0, so utterly overwhelming support there. And then the same day, Canadian lawmakers also passed an amendment asking the International Olympic Committee to move next year's Winter Olympics from China to another country because of the Uyghur situation.
I did think it was interesting that Trudeau abstained.
Right. Yeah, he abstained. He said, oh, that's a loaded term. So there were some abstentions, but of those who voted, everyone voted yes. Right. So, yeah, that reflects poorly on Trudeau, I think. But, yeah, that was Monday. And then on Thursday, the Parliament of the Netherlands passed a motion saying the same thing. What China is doing to the Uyghur minority is genocide. That was the first European nation to make this call. So we now have three countries that have given this designation, and I think it's encouraging, really, to finally see some momentum building against these atrocities that are happening there in northwest China.
We've talked about it before, but maybe you can just remind us of what atrocities they're looking at.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, we've gone through this a few times, and it is emotionally taxing to spell it out, but I think we have to keep doing it, not just on Trumpet Hour, but really any publication, any country or organization, any individual who says they care about human rights, anyone who's ever read about the Holocaust and said, if I had been there, I would have done my part to sound the alarm and to try to bring an end to this. We have to keep on describing what's happening in Xinjiang because it is a Holocaust against the Uyghur people, and it's happening right now, 2021, every week, every day. If we look at the report that the Trump administration published, they cover it really well there. They enumerate some of these specific atrocities. They mention forced sterilizations that are happening to Uyghur women, forced abortions, forced marriages by Uyghur women to non-Uyghur men. They talk about long-term separation of Uyghur children from their families. They detail some of the specific torture practices, the rape that's happening there. They don't mention the organs being harvested out of Uyghur bodies, being harvested from them and sold, but there are plenty of other reports about that. So this is just, it's dark, it's twisted, it's utterly evil, this situation that's happening. And I think it's entirely appropriate that the U.S. stepped up and applied the genocide label to it. And I think it's commendable that a couple of other countries are finally following suit, but it is too few. You know, Europe especially, they always talk very big about human rights. But where are all the other countries when it comes to actually taking a stand when a Holocaust is happening again?
Well, yeah, what you were saying about just how important it is that we continue to bring these things up, I think especially when you look at the kind of momentum that China is building in taking over, dominating trade relationships, dominating all kinds of important sectors within the global economy. And there are a lot of nations that are in positions to, they have to make decisions about how much they're going to engage with the Chinese Communist Party, the communist-led regime in China. And there are a whole lot of nations that are just casting aside these kinds of concerns and saying, we really have no choice but to go ahead and do business with China. And China is taking advantage of that in arena after arena. And you would have to say that Europe would be the most prominent among those.
You would hope so. There was the mantra, never again, right. You know, that came mostly out of European nations after the Holocaust. Never again will we allow a government to systematically attack one of its minorities the way the you know, Germans did to the Jews. But here it is happening once again, and the Germans seem to be the most eager to kick their cooperation with China into a higher gear. Mm. So it's very shameful.
So what literature would you point people to for more information on this, Jeremiah?
There's an article that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote about a year ago. It's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And this article is built around a Bible prophecy that talks about an era called the Times of the Gentiles that will begin shortly before this whole age ends. And Mr. Fleury talks about how American and British leadership, for many years, that was a stabilizing force for the world, for the most part. You know, those countries were imperfect, of course, but they had biblically influenced beliefs in the God-given rights of individuals. They believed in the rule of law and the injustice of government tyranny. So they did stabilize the world for many years, but that era is now ending, and the times of the Gentiles is beginning. And in this new era, Mr. Fleury explains that we can expect the rule of law and any kind of limitations on government power to just disappear. he actually specifically mentions Xinjiang, China in that article. And he says that what's happening there is a preview of just how dark and how twisted the times of the Gentiles will be. So I would encourage anyone who wants to understand that to check out that article, The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man.
That really is just such a critical prophecy for us to keep our eyes on. And when you look at what's happening with these, with what China is doing, it really does give you a vivid picture of what is going to be far more prevalent across the globe very soon. Thank you, Jeremiah. It is forbidden in many circles in America to point to any evidence of election fraud. Well, the company at the heart of so much of the controversy is lashing out at its critics. For this story, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we're just over a month into the Biden administration now. But as you say, the fight over the election results is burning intensely. The Dominion Voting Systems, that's the major voting machine, it's the second biggest voting machine company in the United States, has sued Mike Lindell on Monday. He's the CEO of MyPillow and acquaintance of President Trump, who recently produced a documentary that some of us here in the office actually watched last week, entitled Absolute Proof. And so for that documentary and some other speeches and social media posts he made, he got himself on the roster that Dominion Voting Systems is suing. That documentary in particular points to the role that a Chinese cyber attack may have played in stealing the 2020 election. Of course, Dominion denies those charges, and it have sued Lindell for $1.3 billion. That seems to be their go-to number because it's the same number they sued Rudy Giuliani for earlier in the month and Sidney Powell before that. So all three together, that's up to $3.9 billion in lawsuits. That's 39 times their annual revenue. And they indicated they may not be done. So they're definitely going hard and heavy trying to make sure that people don't think they stole the election. But what's amazing to look at is just the confidence of the people they're suing in the evidence they have. Now, Sidney Powell hasn't said much, but Rudy Giuliani said that he's looking at a counter lawsuit, and his quote, we said the Dominion's defamation lawsuit for $1.3 billion will allow me to investigate their history, their finances, and their practices fully and completely. The amount being asked for is quite obviously intended to frighten people of faint heart. So he's not backing down at all, and Mike Lindell the same. His statement was a little more pithy, but he just said, "You bring it on, Dominion, because I want everyone to see." Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a pretty bold thing to say to a company that you've accused of hacking the elections in the most powerful democracy in the world that takes up a pretty high level of technical expertise. They could really get back at you if they wanted to, but they're very confident in these in their results, and so there looks like they're shaping up to be some pretty dramatic legal action in the weeks ahead.
What's interesting is the evidence that Mike Lindell presented in his documentary, and that Rudy Giuliani has talked about, that Sidney Powell has talked about. They're talking about a specific manifestation of some of the vulnerabilities of these Dominion machines, but this is actually information that's been out in the public and that has been discussed openly for some time. You know, Dominion is going so hard after these few critics, but in some ways what they're saying isn't any different than what's already been exposed.
Right, because though now his documentary on Absolute Proof has details about like a Chinese cyber attack, and that is going to take a little bit more investigation to prove. But what I find the interesting thing is that his critics are coming back, and their defense is like, oh no, it's like that couldn't happen because it's impossible to rig the election. Like, well, no, it's definitely not impossible. I mean, there was an HBO documentary, I think last year, titled Kill Chain, showing just how easy it is to rig an election, because they're, like Chris Krebs has said, this is the securest election in U.S. history. And it's like, well, there's no way that can be true, because in the past you counted by hand or with an adding machine. So you have to like rig every vote. You need a corrupt official rigging every vote that's rigged. When you've got now, you've got three voting machine companies that count 90% of the votes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just takes some malicious software in any one of those to rig hundreds of thousands or even millions of votes. And the man who a Finnish cybersecurity analyst who helped with that Kill Chain documentary has actually hacked into Dominion voting machines just to prove that it could be done, or at least hacked into some of the hardware from a company that Dominion voting machines bought out. So, I mean, this is definitely, he's pointed out this, that whether it's connected to the internet or not, it's like they all have modems so they can be connected to the internet. So it's like hacking them is something, even remotely, is something that can and has been done in the past. So it's definitely a very realistic possibility. And anyone who says that it couldn't have been hacked doesn't know what they're talking about. The question is definitely, was it? And that's what Mike Lindell and Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell are trying to prove in court. And the ironic thing is that they've been trying to get this in court for a while, and they keep being thrown out for absence of evidence. But like I said, if you know anything about law, like the burden of proof is on the prosecutor. So as long as like Powell or Giuliani's suing Dominion, they have the burden of proof, which is harder. Now, if Dominion sues them, the burden of proof is on Dominion to prove that they didn't rig the election, and they have to like surrender all the documentation to prove that they didn't rig the election, which ironically may actually, if they did and they're trying to cover it up, makes it easier to investigate.
Well, what stuns me is just how much the nation generally has completely moved on from this, that the media, the social media companies, big tech companies, like virtually everyone out there, the entire political class, have cast this into the dustbin of history, all of the questions surrounding the fraud in this past election. So it is going to take something very dramatic before this actually is exposed and brought back out into under public scrutiny in a way that would have any kind of impact on events, because it's definitely something that has been cast aside. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with these lawsuits. And it could very well yield more information than what we have seen to this point. If you want to learn more about this, read the cover story of the newest Trumpet, America Has No Helper, that is available on the Trumpet site right now. It was the subject of the Trumpet brief last night from our editor-in-chief. And he's been writing quite a lot about this subject, and we need to keep our eyes on what's happening there. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, anti-Americanism still evident in European nations and in the transatlantic relationship, and still more evidence of President Biden's pro-Iran policy. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Despite Joe Biden becoming America's president and supposedly bringing back an era of re-engagement with the rest of the world, the rest of the world doesn't necessarily seem interested in re-engaging with America. This was on display this week at a security conference in Europe. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, last weekend was the Munich Security Conference, or at least a trimmed down special edition version of the Munich Security Conference that wasn't the large scale event that it typically is because of coronavirus and the associated restrictions. But the big message of this conference was really meant to be America is back, and Joe Biden, President Biden, attended that conference virtually at least. And this was the message that he took there. He said that it was a signal to the world. He stood up and announced America is back. He said the Transatlantic Alliance is back. We're not looking backwards. We're looking forwards together. And there were plenty of European politicians as well that were keen to get up and talk about this alliance. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that Germany stands ready for a new chapter in transatlantic relations. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said it's up to us, the United States and Europe, to strengthen our cooperation again. She talked about them going shoulder to shoulder. But you know, talk is easy, as we mentioned so often when talking about the European Union. They're up there talking this way for the European leader. Well, for all of them, really, it's a big way of them signaling how much they disliked President Trump, and you know, it's Joe Biden putting down President Trump, and then it's the other European leaders talking about how bad that foreign policy was. When it comes down to, okay, well, what does this mean? This is when you saw a clear disconnect. So Germany's talking about, well, or America's attending this conference and talking about, okay, well, we need to kind of stand together and confront Russia. And then Europe's response is kind of, yeah, no, actually, we need to keep trading with Russia. We don't have any plans to confront Russia. We should instead, quote, offer cooperation to Russia. And then the next kind of bits of the meeting is America standing up. Well, we need to stand shoulder to shoulder. Yes, we hear what your European leaders are saying. We need to stand shoulder to shoulder to confront China. And again, then the European leaders are like, well, actually, as Ms. Merkel said, that China proves perhaps even more complicated than Russia. And they talk and said, you know, they made no concrete commitments on China and instead talked about how actually Europe does need to keep trading with China. So what this conference really revealed is that all of this talk about a new transatlantic relationship and a new relationship between Europe and America is just that. It's just talk. There's nothing really substantive about it. And it reveals something very important. Europe has spent the last few years talking about how their disagreement with America, they've kind of focused all of that on President Donald Trump.
Right.
We disagree with Donald Trump. We disagree with Donald Trump. We disagree with Donald Trump. You have Joe Biden in there, and the optics have changed. The talk has changed. They'll, you know, clap each other on the back and act more chummy with each other. But fundamentally, that split that was there under Mr. Trump is still there. Their disagreement is not with President Trump. It's a much more fundamental disagreement with the United States as a whole. It's something much bigger than just one man. And Joe Biden coming in has not changed that at all.
And if you know Bible prophecy, that is no surprise whatsoever.
That's right. And even just recent history. We have an article that covers all of that by Jeremiah in the previous, the March trumpet print, not the one that just came out this week, called China and Europe Thick as Thieves. And in that article, he goes through a critical trade deal that Europe and China signed right on the eve of Joe Biden coming into office. Again, making a clear signal here that Europe is making a permanent change and that they're throwing their lot in with the Communist Party of China, not the United States. And that article gives you all the details of why that news event is significant and why they made that decision. But it also talks about the prophecy, because there are very specific prophecies. You know, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been talking about watching Germany and China all the way back. I think it was either 2010 or 2011. And I remember hearing him say that, and I do not remember anybody anywhere in the world talking about that relationship at that point. Then 2, 3, 4 years after that, you start to get people talking about a special relationship between Germany and China. It starts to emerge that China is Angela Merkel's most common visited overseas or outside of Europe's territory at that period in time. And now you're seeing this trade deal. Now you're seeing, as we heard from Jeremiah in the first half, China emerges this genocidal power, really, and Europe siding with that over the leader of the free world, which is a development that I think 10, 15 years ago, people would have found astonishing. But Mr. Fleury talked about that because of a very specific prophecy in Isaiah chapter 23. And this prophecy says that Europe would have this trade alliance with China. It talks about it as being a mart of nations or a market of nations, and it talks about all of these different overseas trade going on between these two different powers, and it uses biblical language to describe those powers. And then there are so many other scriptures that talk about a siege that is going to, that God is bringing against America. And, well, how do you besiege America? Well, it would be a trade embargo from all the other powers that are not America. So what we're seeing building is just very specific fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And Jeremiah's article will take you through that in much more detail and point to the hope behind that prophecy as well.
Oh, that's marvelous. We'll put a link to a couple of other articles on that subject, the Mart of Nations and also the Atlantic Rift, in our booklet, He Was Right, that Herbert Armstrong was talking about this rift between America and Europe that is prophesied in the Bible quite some time ago. And when you add what Gerald Fleury has said about the Mart of Nations, that was something that Mr. Armstrong didn't focus on, that we've learned a lot more about in recent years, and then we've seen that coming to fruition before our eyes. Quite fascinating to watch that happen. I think you put it in very stark terms there. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Yet more evidence of President Biden's pro-Iran policy is showing up in its treatment of Saudi Arabia, a move the White House is making could really undermine the U.S.-Saudi alliance. For this, we'll go back to Brenton Octagon.
The CIA is due to classify a report this week that directly looks at the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, who was the journalist that was killed inside the Saudi Arabian embassy in Istanbul a couple of years ago. Now, at the time, all links linked back, obviously, to the Saudi Arabian government, but just to how far up the food chain that went, it was unsure, although people did suggest that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was behind the killing and directly ordered it. And that is what the CIA report is about to come out and say, that it was ordered, this death was ordered by the Crown Prince. Now, this is something that the Trump administration already understood and already knew. The Trump administration sanctioned 18 Saudi Arabian officials over the murder. However, they refused to directly call out the prince, or at least subject to him to further sanction, because understandably, he is the up-and-coming leader of Saudi Arabia. His father is, I think he's 85, King Salman. And so everyone in the region knows that if you want something to be done in the future, or even now inside Saudi Arabia, you talk to the Crown Prince. So he was really key and critical for President Trump's, let's say, pro-Israeli foreign policy, anti-Iran foreign policy,
right,
to bring this guy on board. And so he refused to directly call out MBS, as he's known, for the killing. However, the Biden administration said, and even campaigned, Joe Biden campaigned on this, that he was going to really get to the bottom of it and actually publish a report such as this, and make it so sure, make sure that everybody knew who was behind the killing, and he's going to do so today.
It's easy to see this as part of a pattern that we're looking at with the Biden administration and the way that it is prioritizing Iran over all other interests in the Middle East, it seems. Any speculation as to why they felt it was so critical to publicize this in a way that really promises to break down relations with Saudi Arabia pretty considerably?
Yeah, and not just with Saudi Arabia, but this individual who is not a friend of the Obama administration, who was very close to Jared Kushner until this murder, when Kushner kind of gave him some distance, Kushner being the son-in-law to President Trump. Obviously, the Biden administration has to make out that Saudi Arabia is at least as wicked as Iran. If President Obama came out and said that the Saudis need to learn to share the environment, share the Middle East with Iran, then it follows that Iran, he believes Iran is at least on equal terms about how wicked they are, being a sponsor of terrorism. And so, I mean, we said this back going to, let's say, the second term of President Obama, that it is going to be his goal to make Saudi Arabia out to be the worst kind of pariah state. And that's the type of terminology that Joe Biden used on the campaign trail, that Saudi Arabia is a pariah and MBS is a pariah. Not Iran, Saudi Arabia is. And so this makes sense. they need, as much as they would like, to have American public opinion behind their pro-Iranian moves. And so it makes sense then to make Saudi Arabia look just as bad. Now, it is interesting that a couple of weeks ago, I think Richard reported about how you had a couple of Iranians that were convicted in a European court for a couple of decades in prison for trying to attack a march inside European territory with massive explosions. And that was out of an embassy there inside inside Europe. And yet, you know, you don't have Javad Zarif being sanctioned, because that was Javad Zarif's man, who is kind of the foreign policy guy for the Iranians. You didn't see him being sanctioned by the Biden campaign over that. You actually saw the reverse happened. Sanctions were gone from him for Javad Zarif. And so there is obviously this big campaign push. The first couple of things that they did when the Biden administration came into power was reduce ties with Saudi Arabia, pull out of the Saudi-led war in Yemen, stop the arms sales that we've talked about going to Saudi Arabia. And this is just the next pro-Iranian, anti-Saudi move that we see by this administration.
So prophetically speaking, the divide between the United States and Saudi Arabia is to be expected.
Yes, we do expect that. Psalm 83 discusses an end-time alliance that is actually going to be an anti-American alliance, an anti-Israel alliance, and Saudi Arabia, or the Ishmaelites, as it's mentioned there in that psalm, they are part of this alliance that is going to be basically a number of nations, so-called moderate Arab states, coming together in an alliance with Europe, and the United States is not a part of it. Now, most of these states that are currently allied with the United States, let's say going back 2 months ago, a lot of those are going to jump on board with this Psalm 83 alliance with European backer instead. Europe kind of replacing the traditional role that the United States has done inside the region as the leading pro anti-Iranian force. That's what the U.S. has done in support of these other Arab states. Prophecy indicates Europe is going to take the helm of that alliance. And so we do expect Saudi Arabia and even the state of Israel to look for other allies and look further north towards Europe.
And where would you send people for more information, Brent?
People can read our Trend article about that. It's called An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. Russia is expanding its military presence in another of its former Soviet satellite states. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the defense minister of Armenia announced on Monday that Armenia welcomes a new plan from Moscow to expand Russia's military base inside of their territory. So this is a base that actually dates back to the Soviet era, back when Armenia was part of the Soviet Union. It was one of those 14 countries that were all forged into one under Soviet power. And since the 1940s, Russia has had a big base in Gyumri, Armenia, which is near the border with Turkey. And then even after the Soviet Union collapsed and Armenia became independent, they still let Russia keep this facility operational. And by the mid-1990s, the Gyumri location was a fully fledged military base once again, with about 3,000 Russian soldiers there. So that's been the case ever since. But Armenia just lost a war last year against another Soviet nation, its neighbor Azerbaijan. There were about 5,000 people killed in that war, and Armenia ended up having to cede some swaths of territory to Azerbaijan as a result. And so some Armenians are now saying, we need a stronger military presence from Russia to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. The Russians, for their part, are just delighted by that. They've already been able to deploy thousands of troops to Azerbaijan as a result of the war. That was a big victory for Vladimir Putin, because it was the first time Russia's ever had troops in Azerbaijan. And now it looks like a double victory for Russia, because Armenia is saying they want Russia to expand its military presence and also to deploy some Russian soldiers where they never had any before, which is near the border with Azerbaijan. So it's amazing to me that Russia emerged from this conflict with just a significantly deeper military boot print in both of these countries, both Azerbaijan and Armenia. So pretty impressive victory there, really, for Russia.
Talk about this in the context of Vladimir Putin's overarching strategy for bolstering Russian power.
Sure, yeah. We've spoken several times about this landmark statement that Putin made back in 2005, pretty early in his 21-year reign now. And that was when he said that the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. That was important because it really gave us kind of a roadmap for a huge part of his foreign policy. And in the years since he's said that, we've seen him do everything he can to reverse that catastrophe. He's trying to rebuild the Soviet Union. Not so much the economics of it. He knows that that was, you know, a policy that was doomed to fail. But what he misses is the prestige and the power that Russia had when all of that territory and all of those people were under Moscow's control. And that's what he's really been trying to rebuild. That was the motivation behind Putin's invasion of the former Soviet nation of Georgia 13 years ago. That was the motivation behind his invasion of Ukraine 7 years ago. In both of those cases, he took territory that had been under Moscow's control during Soviet days, and he brought it back to Kremlin control. And then we're also seeing Putin assert more and more control over Belarus, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, which we spoke about last week. In all of these former Soviet nations, he's just asserting more and more power over them. And now he's doing the same thing in the Caucasus with both Azerbaijan and Armenia. And it's all driven by that same goal of reestablishing Russian power over its periphery.
Pretty remarkable to watch this happening. Jeremiah has an article up at thetrumpet.com, Russia's expanding military presence in Armenia. And it points to a booklet that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written about Vladimir Putin and his role in biblical prophecy, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. You can go check both of those out under the links that we will include in our show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. One last story. We'll finish by looking at the mountains of cash that environmentalists have spent pushing the narrative about man-made climate change. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Capital Research Institute republished a report this week that that caught my eye. It was pretty fascinating that they're going through just a number of environmental groups, like I said, putting mountains of cash to push the global warming ideology. They chronicled actually up to $2.4 billion in 2019. And that included money from the World Wildlife Fund, the Environmental Defense Fund, the Natural Resource Defense Council, the Sierra Club, and all these money, just pushing money into the this global warming ideology, which is fascinating because Thomas Sowell's mentioned this in the past that. Really, when you're looking at ideologies, I mean, investigating them, it pays to follow the money because, like I said, if you're a scientist or you're a researcher, and you have to decide what you're going to research, you go where the grant money is. And so, like I said, if the government gives grants, the government agents, their vested interest is that, like, we want to make ourselves relevant and increase our power, and therefore, any research that says that the government needs to regulate the economy helps us out. So we'll give grant money to researchers that are finding that that's true. Mm-hmm. The government needs to regulate the economy. And Thomas Sowell kind of explains it kind of makes this feedback loop where, well, people will say, like, oh, well, most scientists believe global warming. It's like, well, I think a lot of the ones that don't, sometimes they have they won't get government funding. Maybe some oil companies will fund them. You do have that side of it. But just really interesting just to see how much money these environmental groups and other groups are pouring into research that confirms what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. Because the article we'll put in the show notes for this is the deadly climate change deception, which by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, which really points out that, I mean, the evidence for catastrophic global warming isn't there. Even the evidence for mild global warming couldn't be contested. But there is definitely evidence of natural disasters, hurricanes, which don't necessarily have anything to do with global warming, earthquakes, which have nothing to do with global warming, fires, which some cases yes, some cases no, have to do with temperatures. But it's, so those things are increasing. But the Bible says, or Jesus Christ said in Matthew 24, that those things are like a sign of the end times. But if you can put $2.4 billion into convincing people that those things are due to burning coal, then you become blinded to the signs of the times.
The deadly climate change deception, that is the article by our editor-in-chief. It's actually a chapter in our booklet, Why Natural Disasters. It's important to look at what's happening with these disasters in the big picture of Bible prophecy, because the Bible definitely talks about some of these disasters that we see taking place around us, and the more that people point to climate change, the less they point to the and understand the real cause of those disasters. Thank you, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal, and thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Dwight Eisenhower: in preparing for battle, I have always found that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.